Welcome to In Tune with the Opera Company of Philadelphia,
the place to learn everything you need to know about upcoming opera company productions.
Hi, I'm Mike Bolton. I'm the Director of Community Programs for the Opera Company.
And I'm Maren Montalbano. I'm happy to be here again. Today, I think we're going to be talking about a diva opera, right?
Absolutely.
Yes.
Puccini's Tosca.
Yes, I'm really excited about that.
So many people love Tosca. It's the ultimate diva opera, but, you know, it has so many great arias to it, too. Cavaradossi's two great arias, Recondi d'Armonia, E dolce avan le stelle.
Right, and Tosca's Visi d'arte. Well, and then there's that the dramatic confrontation that, you know, Tosca and Scarpia have. And, of course, her leap of Castel Sant'Angelo that it has started many, many stories about.
Oh, right. Right.
We'll get into that.
You know, I think during the 2000s, there were two or three seasons or so where the opera company didn't have a whole lot of Puccini. And in the past four seasons or so, we've done really beautiful, memorable productions. Turandot, La Bohème, Butterfly, Johnny Skeeky. And then this season, Tosca is the last opera that's part of the Opera at the Academy series. So we're really sending it off with a bang. And who knows, maybe there is actually more Puccini in the Opera Company of Philadelphia's future, but we're not saying that.
So. Well, what's on tap for this edition of In Tune with the Opera Company of Philadelphia?
We're going to talk a little bit about Giuseppe Verdi and how he almost wrote his own Tosca. We'll have a full plot synopsis. We'll talk about Tosca's historical context with Napoleon and whatnot. We'll have our last Academy of Music moment with Maureen Lynch. We'll talk to Martha Hitchens, who is the timpanist in the orchestra pit for all of our productions. We have musical excerpts, all of that and more.
All of this coming up. Stay tuned as we'll be right back after this message.
Giacomo Puccini is famous for the grace and strength of his glorious heroines. Enter Floria Tosca, a diva with flashing eyes and a jealous heart who loves Mario Cavaradossi. When he is taken as a political prisoner, his captor, Baron Scarpia, has met his match in Tosca. Three dazzling stars make their OCP debuts in this production. Beautiful Romanian soprano Adina Nicescu sings the title role, and sizzling Brazilian-Italian tenor Tiago Arancam is her Cavaradossi, as Scarpia, formidable Russian baritone Boris Stutsenko, in the acclaimed Grand Classic Opera Company of Philadelphia production. Performances of Tosca run from April 29th through May 8th for five performances only at the Academy of Music. Order your subscriptions today at www.operafilla.org or by calling 215-732-8400.
Looking for ways to have your children or grandchildren experience opera? Then mark your calendars for Saturday, February 12th, and bring them to the PNC Arts Alive Family Day at the Opera, a day-long open house event at the Academy of Music where children of all ages can sing a little bit, dance a little bit, learn about their voice, and help them appreciate the world of opera. Plus, you'll be able to go into artist dressing rooms, stand on the stage of the Academy of Music, go into the orchestra pit, and more. PNC Arts Alive Family Day at the Opera, Saturday, February 12th, from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. Sign up to get Opera Company email at www.operafilla.org to have more information and alerts delivered right into your email inbox. PNC Arts Alive Family Day at the Opera. Share the experience of opera.
Welcome back to In Tune with the Opera Company of Philadelphia. I'm Maren Montalbano. After a few operatic missteps, Giacomo Puccini became an overnight sensation with his third opera, Manon Lescaut. When it came time to write Tosca, he had clearly become the heir apparent to Giuseppe Verdi. OCP's Mike Bolton tells us about how Puccini had to fight his way to get the rights to Tosca.
Giacomo Puccini painted indelible portraits of his heroines, from Manon, Mimi, and Minnie, to Liu, Turandot, and Tosca. He was inspired by his heroines to create great art. He knew when he first saw Victorien Sardou's play La Tosca
in 1889 when it toured Italy that he must set the play to music. A little more than 2 weeks after the premiere of his opera Edgar, he wrote to his publisher Ricordi, begging him to acquire the rights to Sardou's La Tosca. Quote, "I implore you to take the necessary steps in order to obtain Sardou's permission. I see the opera which exactly suits me." Sardou did not grant the rights to Puccini, perhaps because he was, at that time, an unknown composer, or perhaps he preferred to have the opera set by a French composer. The topic of Tosca would resurface 6 years later. In the interim came career-making successes for Puccini: Manon Lescaut in 1893 and La Bohème in 1896. Puccini was looking for his next topic, and the two most serious considerations were Maeterlinck's Pelléas and Mélisande and an opera on the last days of Marie Antoinette. Puccini again returned to Sardou's La Tosca. Its sensational subject and structure would be in line with the successful new string of Verismo operas by Giordano, Mascagni, and Leoncavallo, and Puccini wanted to keep up with this new artistic wave that was in vogue. Plus, La Tosca had been embraced triumphantly throughout Europe, frequently with the celebrated actress and Sardou muse Sarah Bernhardt as the heroine. La Tosca had been performed over 3,000 times in France alone. The challenge for Puccini was that Ricordi had managed to purchase the rights to Sardou's play. Ricordi asked writer Luigi Illica to set the libretto, which was then given to composer Alberto Franchetti. Franchetti and Illica met with the playwright in Paris to discuss the opera. Also in attendance at this meeting was Giuseppe Verdi. Verdi was a longtime friend of Sardou's and was in Paris to oversee the French premiere of his opera Otello. Verdi was amazed by Illica's libretto and had seriously considered setting Tosca himself, and the only thing that prevented the 81-year-old from doing so was his age. Word got back to Puccini, and he begged Ricordi again to give him the opera. But what to do? Franchetti had the rights to the opera. The legend has it that Ricordi and Illica met with Franchetti. They discouraged him from setting this libretto as an opera. Tosca was too violent and brutal, with Cavaradossi's torture, the onstage attempted rape of Tosca by Scarpia, Tosca's murder of Scarpia, Cavaradossi's execution, and Tosca's fatal leap. It was too much, and Tosca might not be a sympathetic heroine. Whether or not this was true, Franchetti got cold feet and relinquished the rights. Ricordi signed a contract with Puccini soon after. Puccini worked with librettists Luigi Illica and Giuseppe Giacosa to fine-tune the libretto. He even met with the 65-year-old playwright. Sardou asked him for 50,000 francs for a composing fee, but Puccini negotiated an agreement with Sardou so that he would get 15% of the gross profits. Sardou would help Puccini in condensing the five-act play into three acts and in providing all sorts of unsolicited advice. Puccini fought with his librettists for improvements as well. Illica's libretto, which had been given to Franchetti, was too long and verbose. Giacosa found little opportunities for poetry in the plot. The two had also envisioned the opera's finale with Tosca going mad instead of throwing herself over the Castel Sant'Angelo. Puccini guided the two to tailor and create a libretto that even Sardou was better than his play. And as we know, they kept Sardou's original ending with Tosca jumping over the parapet. Puccini went through great pains to ensure veracity in his composition. For the Act I conclusion, he researched different settings of the Te Deum that were sung in Roman churches. He wrote a cantata that Tosca sings offstage in Act II in the style of Paisiello, a composer during the time of Tosca setting, ensured that the music that opens the third act was in tune with the actual bells of the Castel Sant'Angelo, and more. When the opera went into rehearsal in Rome, Puccini's preferred conductor, Arturo Toscanini, was booked at La Scala and couldn't premiere the opera. And Enrico Caruso had hoped to sing Cavaradossi at the premiere, but the plum assignment went to Emilio De Marchi. The premiere of a new opera by Puccini was a national event. The opening night crowd was a who's who, and attended by heads of state, including Italy's prime minister, Queen Margherita, Roman dignitaries, as well as several of Puccini's rivals, the composers Pietro Mascagni, Francesca Cilea, and Ildebrando Pizzetti. Additional drama was added to opening night when there was a bomb scare, and right after the curtain was raised, when a near riot almost broke out when latecomers demanded to be allowed into the theater and into their seats. The opening night went well, with several of the arias encored, but critics were not terribly warm in their response and targeted the libretto for most of their criticism. The critics didn't seem to affect audience response, though, and the opera played to packed houses for 20 additional performances. Sold-out houses tend to be a traditional reaction to this favorite opera. Our last performances of Tosca were in March 2000, so there's lots of Philadelphians just waiting to see this opera again. So if you don't have your tickets yet, order them today. Let's hear a little bit of that March 2000 performance of Tosca as we hear American baritone Greg Baker as the evil Baron Scarpia.
Tre spiri, una carrozza, prezzo, segui de punque vara, non visto, proveni.
Sta bene, mi convegno.
Palazzo farnete.
That was Mike Bolton, the Opera Company's Director of Community Programs, talking about the world premiere of Tosca. Coming up, we'll talk to OCP's iconic timpanist, Martha Hitchens, hear some music from the opera as performed by Enrico Caruso, and more. Up next, our Academy of Music moment. Here's OCP chorus member Julianne Green to tell us more.
In its 153-year history, many historic and interesting events have happened inside the Academy of Music, including important recent opera company performances like Tan Dun's Tea, A Mirror of Soul, David de Chiara and Bernard Uzan's Cyrano, and Richard Daniel Poor and Toni Morrison's Margaret Garner. Tenor Juan Diego Flores made his United States operatic debut with the Opera Company of Philadelphia in Rossini's The Italian Girl in Algiers in 2000 and more. But you may be surprised to learn of the impressive cultural role the Academy has played throughout its history. Maureen Lynch, operations manager of the Academy, fills us in on some of the fascinating events that have happened at the theater.
Did you know that the first public film screening took place at the Academy of Music in 1870 when Henry R. Heil exhibited motion pictures before 1,600 people with his new invention called the phasmotrope? Fast forward into the 1980s, and you have Martin Scorsese filming Age of Innocence, starring Daniel Day-Lewis and Michelle Pfeiffer, and he wants to put in the beginning of the movie a scene where Daniel Day-Lewis' character enters the Academy, drawn up in a carriage in front of the building, and ascends the balcony steps to a proscenium box where Michelle Pfeiffer and Winona Ryder are seated, and that proscenium box was the balcony level south proscenium box, and they were watching an opera. So in order to do this, the director set up an opera on stage, and he had to fill the house, but who could afford to pay that many actors to be extras? So what they did was they had four templates of Victorian-dressed characters, two women, two men, and they would intersperse the audience with these cardboard characters amid some live actors dressed in period costumes, so that when the camera did a quick twirl through the audience, you might see a little bit of movement from the live, but did the effect. And at some point, somebody put one of those cardboard characters in my office, and I opened the door one morning and was panicked to see a Victorian character smiling at me. A little note, the film was at the Academy was done in May, and they needed a snow scene, so they cut down the trees to pruning level in front of the Academy. But it was interesting to go out at 5 a.m. and see a snow-strewn Broad Street and the trees all covered with snow in the middle of May. It was quite wonderful. So yeah, even if you only watch the beginning of Age of Innocence, you can see those portions of the Academy filming. When we opened in 1857, there was a custom-made wood floor that could be installed over the main level seats and attached to the stage, so it formed a continuous arena effect. So you'd walk in, you could walk straight to stage. And this was used often over several decades. One of the reasons it was used for was for the opening night cotillions and the parties, the most anticipated in Philadelphia society. And then President Grant was nominated for his second term of office on the stage of the Academy of Music. And basically, it was the Republican National Convention who nominated him. Wild West shows were put on that floor. Buffalo Bill Cody, Annie Oakley. The booking calendar of the Academy was frequent, varied, and most unusual at times. The first football game was between Princeton and the University of Pennsylvania in 1889. The score was 0-0, as it was primarily a charity fundraiser. We also had an indoor ice skating presentation featuring Carrie Augusta Moore in February of 1866, and I don't know how they freeze the ice. It's one of those unknown things that if anybody ever finds out, please do let me know. Philadelphians can trace a lot of their milestones of their own life in this building. Did they graduate from our stage? Did they have their wedding reception in our ballroom? Did they attend their first opera? Or even where their source of revenue level was at that time. They started maybe as young people up in the amphitheater and worked their way down to afford little higher priced tickets down in the parquet. There's subtle things that connect this building to Philadelphians in their hearts. And it's an amazing thing. I have people come who have an association with this building that is just amazing. I mean, maybe they were in the stage door canteen when they were serving in the military during World War II and came here to relax and be entertained and have their voice recorded and sent home. Maybe there were some of the women who served and made the food at that stage door canteen. After 150-some years, she's just woven herself into the fabric of the hearts of Philadelphians in general. And being a National Historic Landmark, she not only belongs to Philadelphia with great pride, but she belongs to the nation. And that's quite an outstanding honor for a grand old lady who is a 153-year-old beauty who walks proudly into the future, always accepting change to ensure that her legacy goes on and that people enjoy art on her stage, which is the whole purpose for her existence.
That was the Academy of Music's operations manager, Maureen Lynch, and OCP's Julianne Green. I wonder just how many of you will be putting The Age of Innocence on your Netflix queue.
The Opera Company of Philadelphia offers all sorts of ways to learn about its season and productions. Do you like free preview recitals? Then come to A Taste of Opera at Pennsylvania Academy of Fine Arts. Like informative pre-curtain talks? Then check out Opera Overtures, held 1 hour before each opera. Love opera? Then help us celebrate National Opera Week from October 29th through November 7th. Here's what people are saying about the Opera Company of Philadelphia's free outreach programming.
Opera overtures are an enormous help in appreciating the overall productions. I've enjoyed every one I've been to.
Absolutely illuminating, fun, interesting backstories that are wonderful.
It's enjoyable and it's always educational and very fun.
And I love Taste of Opera. It gives me my fix and my high for the whole week and it keeps me glowing. I recommend it to everybody, and if you have never gone to an opera before, this is a great introduction.
What are you waiting for? Come join us and bring a friend. Find out more about the Opera Company of Philadelphia's educational and outreach events online at www.operaphila.org/community.
Hi, this is Maren Montalbano.
And this is Mike Bolton.
And we're back with In Tune with the Opera Company of Philadelphia.
You know, we do the Taste of Opera pre-production recitals about a week before every opening of every production.
That's
and
right.
Last June, you were there and you sang for us phenomenally well at the Orfei Taste of Opera. And
yes.
What was that like for you?
Oh my gosh, that was so much fun. Performing for that audience, they were so receptive, and they were very much into the story and what was going on, and really nice
yeah,
to talk to.
We have a really dedicated group that goes, and like the commercial says, if you're new to opera or not, It's a great way to introduce people to opera. It gives them little snippets. You get into the museum for free, so then you can go throughout the galleries at the Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts. So it's really just a phenomenal, phenomenal way to learn a little bit about the productions we do.
Right. So the Taste of Opera for Tosca is on Sunday, April 17th. So mark your calendars. Based on Sardou's play La Tosca, Puccini's opera has one of the most dramatic forward-moving plots in all of opera. Here's Mike Bolton to give us a full plot synopsis.
Before we get into a plot synopsis, let's take a look at some of the fascinating history on which Tosca is based. Now, Tosca, according to Sardou's play, takes place in the afternoon and evening of June 17th and the early morning of the 18th in 1800. Putting it in context, we're in the tail end of the Age of the Enlightenment. Mozart had passed some 9 years earlier, but bel canto master Vincenzo Bellini would be born in this year. Paisiello's operas were all the rage in Italy, and Beethoven's Fidelio would premiere 5 years later. The United States was just 24 years old, and President John Adams was about to move into the brand new White House, the first president to live there. Italy was not yet unified, but a collection of small states, and northern Italy was occupied by Austrian forces. The French Revolution had just ended, and Napoleon Bonaparte was quickly making a name for himself. He and his troops had invaded Italy in 1796 and established a republic in Rome 2 years later. The Pope fled to Tuscany, and the republic was ruled by seven consuls, one of whom was named Angelucci. In the opera Tosca, escaped political prisoner Angelotti is a former consul and based on two historical figures, one of whom was actually found hiding in a well, just as Angelotti is in the opera's second act. By September 1799, the Austrians had forced the French north and regained control of Rome and eventually all of northern Italy. Napoleon returned to Italy with his troops, crossing the Alps, and arrived in Marengo on Saturday, June 14th. Austrian forces under Michael von Melas surprised Napoleon around 10 o'clock in the morning, and the French initially fell back. Thinking that the Austrians had indeed won, Melas left his position and returned to Alessandria because of a slight wound. Word was sent to Rome of Napoleon's defeat, and in the opera, at the end of Act 1, the sacristan rejoices in the news that Melas has been victorious over Napoleon, and Tosca is asked to sing a celebratory cantata that evening before King Ferdinand I and Queen Marie Caroline. But by late afternoon, new French forces arrived, and Napoleon attacked the tired Austrians, who retreated and fled by 7 p.m. News was later sent to Rome that Napoleon had been victorious. In Act 2 of the opera, this news interrupts Scarpia, just as Cavaradossi has been brought in after being tortured. Scarpia would have been in charge of political security. In Austrian-dominated Rome, he would have been very pro-Austria and anti-Napoleon. Cavaradossi would have been an idealistic rebel, looking to embrace the freedom now found in France and looking for a unified Italy. Napoleon continued his conquest of Italy, forcing King Ferdinand, his queen, and all Austrian allies out of Italy. Rome would remain under Napoleonic rule for 14 years. Escaped political prisoner and former consul of the Roman Republic, Cesare Angelotti has just escaped from jail. Seeking refuge, he rushes into the church of Sant'Andrea della Valle and hides in the Attavanti family chapel. A sacristan enters, followed by the painter Mario Cavaradossi, who is working on a portrait of Mary Magdalene. Cavaradossi studies the canvas, on which he's combined the blonde-haired beauty whom he's seen praying in the church every day with that of his brunette girlfriend, the singer Floria Tosca. After the sacristan shuffles off, Angelotti emerges from the chapel and is recognized by Cavaradossi, who is his friend and political ally. Angelotti tells him of his escape from the Castel Sant'Angelo, where Rome's corrupt royalist chief of secret police Baron Scarpia has imprisoned him. Cavaradossi promises to help Angelotti, who hides again when they hear Tosca outside. When Cavaradossi lets her in, she questions him. Who is this woman he's painting? His lover? She recognizes her. It's the Marchesa Attavanti. Cavaradossi reassures her, and they sing of their love. When she's gone, Angelotti comes out of hiding and plots his flight with Cavaradossi. Angelotti will disguise himself, as women's clothes were left for him in the chapel. When they hear the sound of a cannon, they know that Angelotti's escape has been discovered by the police, and the two flee to Cavaradossi's villa. The sacristan returns, followed by clerics and choir boys, with the news that Napoleon has been defeated. Their revelry is interrupted by Scarpia, who enters searching for Angelotti. That Cavaradossi had been there moments ago, but not now, sits uneasily with the Roman chief of police. Tosca soon returns in search of Cavaradossi, and Scarpia uses a fan he has found belonging to the Marchesa Attavanti to arouse her suspicions. Thinking that Cavaradossi has been unfaithful, she vows vengeance and hurries off to the villa. Hoping that she will lead him to Angelotti, Scarpia sends his men to follow her and vows to make her his as the choir, clerics, and sacristan intone the Te Deum. Caught up in his own lust for her, Scarpia admits that Tosca makes him forget God. Alone in his apartment at the Palazzo Farnese, Scarpia dines. He has sent a note asking Tosca to join him, and he's looking forward to bending Tosca to his will. Scarpia's spy Spoleta enters and reports that they were unable to find Angelotti at Cavaradossi's villa, but they arrested the painter and have brought him in for questioning. Tosca is also in the palace to perform an anthem in celebration of Napoleon's defeat. Her song rings out from the courtyard below as Cavaradossi is interrogated by Scarpia. Where is Angelotti, he asks. Did you give him food? Did you give him clothing? Is he hiding at your home? Cavaradossi denies all of it. After the performance and having been summoned by Scarpia, Tosca enters the room. Cavaradossi whispers to her not to tell anything that she saw, for if she does, she will kill him. Cavaradossi is taken out. Scarpia questions the diva about Angelotti. As she denies each of Scarpia's accusations, he urges his henchmen to torture Cavaradossi more brutally. When his painful screams are too much, Tosca reveals that Angelotti is hidden in the well in the garden. Bruised and bloodied, Cavaradossi is brought back in. Learning of her betrayal, he curses Tosca's weakness. Sciarrone rushes in with the news that Napoleon has won at the Battle of Marengo, defeating Scarpia's side. Cavaradossi shouts his defiance of tyranny and his hope for liberty as he is dragged to prison. Scarpia starts to finish his dinner. Tosca asks what price needs to be paid in order to save Cavaradossi. Scarpia says it's not money he's interested in. He wants her. Tosca cries that she has devoted her life to art and asks God why he would repay her with such misery. Tosca agrees to give in to Scarpia if he will set Cavaradossi free. Scarpia cannot pardon Cavaradossi, but he will secretly release him after a mock execution. Tosca insists that he write a note of safe passage for both her and Cavaradossi, and while he's writing, Tosca notices a knife, which he takes without his notice. After he has sealed the note, Scarpia advances on Tosca and she stabs him, saying that this is Tosca's kiss, and mocks him for having been killed by a woman. Without taking her eyes off Scarpia's corpse, she goes to the table and takes a bottle of water. She dampens a napkin and washes her fingers. She remembers the safe conduct and looks for it on the writing table, but she can't find it. Looking again, she sees it at last, crumpled up in Scarpia's hand. She lifts his arm and lets it fall limply, tucking the safe conduct into her bosom. She's about to go, but feels remorse, and takes two candles from the table, lights them, and puts one candle to the right of Scarpia's head and the other to the left. She looks around again and sees a crucifix on the wall. She takes it down, carries it over reverently, and kneeling, she puts it on Scarpia's chest. She gets up and very carefully goes out, closing the door behind her. It is dawn. Cavaradossi is brought to a platform in the Castel Sant'Angelo, awaiting execution. He asks for a pen and paper in order to write a farewell note to Tosca and reflects on his love for her. Tosca rushes in with the note of safe conduct and tells Cavaradossi of Scarpia's death. He praises her for her courage, and Tosca explains the plan for the mock execution. She worries, though, whether he'll be able to play his part convincingly, and tells him that he should lie still after the gunshots until she gives him a signal. The firing squad comes in to perform its duties. Shots ring out as Tosca screams and Cavaradossi falls to the ground. Once the firing squad departs, she tells him that it's safe to move, but when he doesn't respond, Tosca realizes Scarpia's treachery. The bullets were real. Having discovered Scarpia's murder, Spoleta and the others come to arrest her, but before they can catch her, Tosca climbs on the battlement and, saying that she and Scarpia will meet before God, hurls herself over the edge to her death.
We'll take a break. Coming up, we'll learn a bit about this production cast, but now we'll get to know OCP's timpanist, Martha Hitchens.
Famed conductor Arturo Toscanini once said that the timpanist was the assistant conductor of the orchestra due to their aural presence in the pit. The opera company's timpanist, Martha Hitchens, has been in our pit for 30 years. And if you're seated in one of the balcony levels of the Academy of Music or the Perlman Theater, you may be very aware of Martha's presence from her energetic and vibrant playing as she rhythmically strikes the kettle drums. We sat down with Martha in the Kimmel Center's Commonwealth Plaza this past June. She snuck out of the orchestra pit just as she had finished playing the overture to Gluck's Orphée et Eurydice to tell us a little bit about herself and playing with the Opera Company of Philadelphia Orchestra.
I was born in Minnesota, but I grew up in western Colorado, and I had never seen an opera. Orchestras came, the Utah Symphony came the most. And the first year I was at Curtis, I bought a ticket to see Carmen. That was the first opera I'd ever seen. And Robert Merrill was singing, and I knew who he was, and I knew a lot of the tunes. But I was very impressive, sitting up in the last row of the amphitheater at the Academy of Music. And I've been down in the pit for 30 years now, so a better seat. And I love being at the side. I feel very much a part of what's going on. One can feel the energy also from the audience. In attending opera, I was fascinated by it because I wasn't quite sure how the Philadelphia audiences would react to it, and they were spellbound during the opera. They were enthusiastic at the end. I thought that was fabulous. And that was a highlight for me, playing, working with him.
What is her routine like on a performance day?
I usually arrive early because I want to ascertain the condition of the timpani. I want to warm up. The humidity level, both the Academy of Music and the Perlman Theater are very dry, so they go sharp.
How does she describe her playing style?
I take a more physical approach to it, and when you see me releasing or that action, I'm trying to get the best possible sound out of the instruments. Opera is wonderful because sometimes it is very rhythmic, and I'm with the trumpets and the trombones, and then other times it's a solo. It's something very subtle when there's something extremely profound going on stage, and it's an amazing moment.
Does she recall any amusing moments from the orchestra pit?
One performance in the Academy early on in my time with the opera company when I actually broke a timpani head during a performance. It was Simone Boccanegra, and there was some huge event on stage in the first act finale that was punctuated by a loud timpani roll, and Alessandro Siciliani pointed to me, and I went straight through the head. It felt like I was playing on paper. You know, it was like the world stopped moving for a moment, and he looked at me, and I shook my head.
And what's it like to play for Jack Mulroney music director Corrado Rivadis?
Corrado he's brilliant, and he has a lot of energy. And I've played under him long enough, and I've played under Ignaz Solzhenitsyn for a long time with the chamber orchestra. They both require more playing on top of the beat. Philadelphia, I don't know if you're aware, has this delayed beat tradition. I'm old enough that I remember Eugene Normandy, and the first time I ever played with him when I was a student at Curtis, his baton came down, and so did my stick, and I was way ahead. And I never quite figured that out. When I first started playing with the opera company, it was the same way. The stick came down, and I was early. So Corrado has a lot of energy, so I really have to anticipate him playing those big drums, trying to get the sound out and be on time and on top is challenging. Plus, he has a great knowledge of the music and the traditions, which I appreciate.
What do her neighbors think of Martha practicing at home?
My neighbors actually enjoyed listening to them. I have one neighbor who says that when she takes a load out of the dryer and hears a timpani roll, she feels like she's really accomplished something. It is more mellow than a drum set or cymbals or something.
We had mentioned earlier that the legendary Enrico Caruso wanted to do the world premiere of Tosca, but the producers had some other ideas. Well, he did certainly go on, needless to say, to a glorious career, frequently singing Cavaradossi. And let's take a listen to him singing Cavaradossi's Act One aria, Recondita Armonia, in a recording from 1909 that most likely was recorded just across the Delaware River at the RCA Camden Studios.
Listening to In Tune with the Opera Company of Philadelphia. I'm Maren Montalbano. The last time the Opera Company performed Tosca was in 2000. It's been a while since we've seen this opera that musicologist Joseph Kernan dubbed a shabby little shocker in the 1950s. Thankfully, most of the world has ignored his criticism of the opera. Bringing this passion-filled opera to life are three singers who are new to the Academy stage. Soprano Adina Nicescu in the title role, tenor Tiago Arancam as her faithful lover Cavaradossi, and baritone Boris Statsenko as the evil Baron Scarpia.
Romanian soprano Adina Nicescu sings the title role for her opera company debut. Known for her portrayal of another Puccini heroine, Madama Butterfly's Chocho San, Nicescu has performed that role with Opera Nationale in Paris, Moscow's Bolshoi Theater, and the Staatsoper Berlin. Of her recent performances of Butterfly at the Dallas Opera, the Dallas Morning News wrote she, quote, produced blazing vocal climaxes as well as hot coals pianissimos, everything eloquently nuanced. No meek shuffling cliche, this butterfly grasped her fate willingly and followed it to its inevitable tragedy. Every moment, every shift of facial expression told a story.
I can't wait to hear her. She's joined by the hot Italian-Brazilian tenor Tiago Arancam in his opera company debut as Cavaradossi. Now, Arancam's recent successes include Don José in Carmen with the Washington National Opera and Cavaradossi with the Frankfurt Opera. Of his performances at the Kennedy Center in Carmen, the Daily Colonial said, quote, "The true star of the opera is Tiago Arancam. The rich and strong tone of Arancam in every aria and recitative he performed brought his performance to an entirely new level with each unique phrase." And the Washington Times said, quote, "His voice is clear and packed with surprising power, enabling him to display his lyric gifts while adding heft to the ensemble numbers."
And then rounding out the principals as Rome's chief of police, Baron Scarpia, formidable Russian baritone Boris Tatsenko makes his opera company debut. He's a frequent leading artist with Moscow's Bolshoi Theater and the Deutsche Oper am Rhein. He's also performed with Royal Opera Covent Garden, the Frankfurt and Stuttgart operas, and more. His Scarpia has been called, quote, "gentle and seductive, but also dismal and demonic" by the Wiesbaden Press. And another critic said that he, quote, "splendidly portrayed the demonic prefect of the Roman police, and with his wonderful velvety timbre, he performed an exceptional musical composition."
If you've seen this production before, you'll remember that it's a classic original Opera Company of Philadelphia production, one of the best created for the company by Boyd Ostroff. Other productions by Mr. Ostroff have included La Bohème, Die Fledermaus, The Marriage of Figaro, The Pearl Fishers, and many more. Jonathan Eaton directs this production, and Jack Moroni, music director, Maestro Corrado Rivaris, conducts the Opera Company Orchestra.
There's all sorts of stories surrounding Tosca about little mishaps.
Like when Tosca fell off the tower and then bounced back up, and the whole audience saw her
bouncing back and forth.
And
that story has been attributed to so many sopranos in so many cities. Who knows where it actually originated? Then there's another great story about Maria Callas performing this opera with Tito Gobbi, and she leaned into the candle and her wig caught on fire. just recently, I would say this is in the past 5 years, a tenor who has performed on the Opera Company of Philadelphia stages previously, I'm not going to say who he is, was performing Tosca, I want to say, in Verona. Can't remember exactly where it was, but there was too much gunpowder in the guns, even though it was fake.
Yeah.
They ended up shooting him in the foot, and he had to, I don't know if they stopped the performance or not, but he was bleeding, and he had to go to the hospital right after the performance.
Oh.
So he actually hurt his foot during the mock execution.
And I heard a story about one time when Pavarotti was playing Cavaradossi, and he, during a rehearsal, went to his executioners walked up to the chorus members and said, "All right, any of you tenors?" And a couple of them raised their hands, and he looked at them and said, "I'm watching you."
And I think one other thing that I just thought of was several years ago, there was a soprano singing Tosca at the Met, and during the fisticuffs with Scarpia, ended up dislocating her jaw in Act Two, and then continued to sing the rest of the performance.
Oh, my goodness.
Again, I'm not going to say who that was, right. But if you have Google, I'm sure you'll be able to find that information out. But anyway, if you want to learn more about, I don't know, I think we've just kind of ruined all of our inside stories, but if you want to learn more about Giacomo Puccini and Tosca, please don't forget to join us for A Taste of Opera, a free preview of the opera at the Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts. It's April 17th from 2 to 3 p.m. Reservations are required for A Taste of Opera, but they can be made by emailing your name, address, and number in your party to outreach@operaphila.org.
And don't forget about the free pre-performance lectures, opera overtures, held 1 hour before each performance in the Parquet Circle section of the Academy of Music. For more information on all of these events, log on to our website at www.operaphila.org/community. Tickets for Tosca are on sale now on subscription and can be purchased by calling 215-893-1018. That's 215-893-1018 or online at www.operaphila.org.
This wraps up our podcast for Tosca. Special thanks, of course, to the Academy of Music's operations manager, Maureen Lynch, Opera Company Orchestra timpanist Martha Hitchens, OCP chorus members Julie Ann Green and Rebecca Whitlow, and of course to Maren Montalbano, our co-host.
Be sure to check out our other podcasts on these season's operas. If you have any questions or comments, please send them via email to outreach@operafilla.org. Thank you again for joining us. I'm Maren Montalbano.
And I'm Mike Bolton. In Tune with the Opera Company of Philadelphia is produced, edited, and engineered by yours truly. I hope to see you at the opera.
Nel tuo cuore s'annida Scorpio. Oh, Tosca. Tosca.